Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and a director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I will try to demystify it in this program with my cool guest. And my guest today is Tim Cushman, who is the chef owner of Oya, a Japanese restaurant in Boston, where he earned numerous awards, including 2008 Food & Wine Magazine Best New Chef and 2012 James Beard Awards Best New Chef Northeast. And Tim just opened Oya New York City in Gramercy last month with his wife and business partner, Nancy Cushman. Well, hello and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having us.
So, how's Oya New York doing?
It's doing great. We've only been open for about 4 weeks, and the response has been just really great, really very positive. So we're, so far so good, and we're very happy.
Yeah, great. So congratulations on opening.
Thank you.
Right. So before we talk about Oya, how did you get into cooking? Originally, I heard you are becoming a musician.
Yes, I have a degree, a bachelor's degree in music from Berklee College of Music in Boston, and I grew up in the Boston area, and actually grew up, our family hunted and cooked a lot. I never thought of being a chef then, but I think it just was ingrained in me from early on. Mm-hmm. And I did take my first job out of high school, and this was in the 1970s, so I'm dating myself here. Mm-hmm. But it was at a farm that had an ice cream stand, and they mm-hmm. used to make the ice cream out of from the cow's milk mm-hmm. that was on the farm. But again, I wasn't, thinking of being
right.
a chef.
Well, it was a farm to table back then already.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was really good ice cream. And they also had a farm stand and the vegetables and everything. And then when I went to Berklee and I graduated in 1980, and my last year in 1979, I got a job in a restaurant in Boston in Faneuil Hall. But it was really just, Faneuil Hall had just opened, I think a year prior to that, or had opened up all the kind of boutique-y shops that were there. And this was a real simple restaurant. And again, it was a summer job for me. Mm-hmm. And then I worked there for about a half a year. And then I left for California mm-hmm. in 1980.
Right, because California is like a music mecca.
So yes. I wanted to go where it was at, so to speak. So I moved to Los Angeles in 1980. And kind of a classic story. I didn't have a car or any money. Mm-hmm. So there was a restaurant down the street, and I got a job in the restaurant, and it turned out the name of the restaurant was Courtney's. It was in Manhattan Beach in Southern California, and the chef, his name is Robert Bell, who was actually from New York, was very creative and inventive, so it piqued my curiosity, and just started out as a dishwasher and a prep cook, and I thought it was just going to be a job to hold me off until I got in a band and went on tour with Led Zeppelin.
Right.
But So kind of quickly, I really started enjoying working in the restaurant, and I started cooking more than prepping. Mm. And
because you're a musician and creative in the kitchen work also.
Yes, yeah. And all of a sudden, it just something went off, and I still really hadn't committed. It probably took me a year before I thought, well, maybe I want to cook, you know, and keep doing this. And the big change came when I started working at a restaurant called Trump's, which is in West Hollywood. It's not related to Donald Trump in any way. But it was, the chef there was Michael Roberts, and it was very California. We had lunch, afternoon tea, where there was a harp player that would play, and all the Hollywood women would come out and do tea,
right.
And then dinner would start at 6, and it was very California. It was kind of stucco whitewashed inside, and there was the art rotated every month. We even had some Andy Warhol paintings, so it's very a real eclectic restaurant.
Right, and the California cuisine, as far as I understand, it's more like ingredient-based, which I think is your style now.
Absolutely, and California was a huge influence on whatever I do now still. As I remember back then, then being 1981, 1982, I remember the chef gave me the keys to his car and said to go over to this person's front yard. There were some wild nasturtiums or nasturtiums growing. You know, go pick some and bring them back. So we came back and we did a dish with nasturtium butter with a wood grilled fish.
Nice.
So we used to have actually one of our line cooks had her own little mini lettuce farm. So. Mm. It was kind of what you're seeing today was happening way back then.
It's amazing.
So, yes.
Right. And then eventually you moved to Chicago to join Let Us Entertain You, which is which owns and operates about 100 restaurants in the U.S.?
Yeah, I think I lost count. I was in Los Angeles for about 7 years. I also worked with Roy Yamaguchi, who is the first Japanese chef I worked with, although it wasn't it was more of a California style with... Mm. He was born in Japan, grew up in Hawaii, was French trained, and he lived in California. So, and the whole mix was shown on the menu, and we were doing creative sashimis way back then, 1982.
Before Nobu started doing jalapeno.
1982-83, we were doing spicy tuna, but not spicy tuna like you know it. It had fresh jalapenos and onions and shiso and. And there was a lot of other, you know, California influences. We actually had a Chinese duck smoking box.
Mm-hmm.
So we were doing, you know, Chinese influenced food and just pure California food because of all the produce that was available.
Right.
So all that really, that eclectic mix from Michael Roberts and Roy Yamaguchi really kind of laid the foundation for showing me there were no boundaries.
Right. So... as far as I understand, you know, Let Us Entertain You. You worked as a corporate chef.
Yes.
Right? So, and then you traveled around the world, including Japan, France, Thailand, Italy, England, Germany, Hong Kong, Mexico, Taiwan, you name it. So, because based on your diverse influence from California cuisine, you were able to manage those things and develop new restaurants concept?
Yes, and working with Let Us Entertain You when I moved to Chicago around 1987, and actually Nancy is from Chicago, and that's where we met.
Right.
But I started working with Let Us Entertain You as one of the corporate chefs, and my job, along with, there was another chef named Russell Bry, we were developing all the menus for all the new restaurants, so it was just whatever Rich Melman, who is the founder, is very creative. Whatever concept we did, we'd travel to do the research. So that's where I went to France, Italy, Mexico. And then actually the first project that we worked on was going back to Los Angeles and opening up an American diner called Ed DeBevick's. It was right on La Cienega. Mm. And a Japanese restaurant group came to the restaurant, really loved it, and wanted to open it in Japan. So I became the kind of the food liaison between the American diner palate was and what the Japanese palate was.
Right.
So we opened a restaurant in Osaka in 1988.
Wow.
So that was my first trip to Japan.
Hmm. And, you know, I also heard on the same trip that, you know, you had a stage, like unpaid short, you know, internship with the bunch of different Japanese traditional restaurants with the translator because the company supported you to have that experience?
Yes, the Japanese restaurant group. And that's when I really fell in love with the Japanese culture because they were so generous. After we opened the restaurant, they kept me there for a few months and gave me an interpreter, and I could go around and stage in restaurants. And I could ask any questions, and the interpreter could tell me what was happening. So that was a mind blowing experience for me, and I went wow. And the first trip there, it's when I first saw we went to a sushi restaurant, and mm-hmm. they did a roll, a maki roll that had it was a BLT roll, mm-hmm. and this was in 1988, and that really stuck out in my mind. Is oh okay, you can do things with the sushi rice that aren't necessarily traditional, but it still works flavor-wise.
Right. So, but it's I don't know if the company Japanese guy's intention, but you're now acting like a Japanese food ambassador, so maybe their investment worked out. So. Right. And what do you think is the benefit of working abroad as a chef?
The benefit of working as a chef?
Working abroad.
There's so much to learn. I mean, I always look at myself as a student forever, and with good reason, because whenever you travel, you always see something new. There's some new flavor, new preparation, new ingredient. And also the exposure you get to working with other people, from the different cultures.
Mm, right. And so... what is the challenges and or fun working in Japanese kitchens? Because I think they have different culture compared to the one here.
Yes, the Japanese kitchens have a lot more history than mm-hmm. The American kitchens do. I mean, hundreds of years. And you can feel that, or you sense it when you're there. And there's an enormous amount of respect, mm-hmm. For everything. There's an enormous amount of structure and organization and dedication. Mm. So that really stood out in precision. Mm. Not only just the flavor is precise, mm-hmm. And the food is very precise, but just the way that it's prepared, the whole process, right. Is very precise.
Mm. So the kitchen is set up differently, or
in a sense. I mean, there is. I mean, Western kitchens also have a hierarchy, mm-hmm. So to speak. So, yeah, there is the path, that you travel. Mm-hmm. And our kitchen actually is set up very different because it's kind of a combination of the two cultures. Mm-hmm. And there's, it really takes a balancing act to make that all work.
Mm. Right. And you learned that you had worked at sushi restaurant, teppanyaki, grill restaurant, tempura, kaiseki, sounds like the whole set of Japanese cuisine.
Yeah, I mean, I spent time in was observing, mm-hmm. I'm not a master sushi chef, and I never claim to be. I'm not Japanese. I'm not trying to be. Mm-hmm. And I'm an American chef, but I've, had a lot of experience with the different foods and flavors, mm-hmm. so I feel confident in working, mm-hmm. Within all the idioms.
Right. Okay. And then when you came back, you decided to open Oya in Boston in 2007. And why Japanese? Because based on your experience, you could have done any kind of restaurant, right?
Yes. And that's a great question. The first two restaurants I worked at in California. To me, they were very elevated, creative flavors, kind of very very special, unique kind of restaurants. Mm. And as I started working over the next probably 15, 20 years, I did a lot more mainstream food, which I love just as much. I mean, things like American Diners and Let Us Entertain You. We did a lot of different Italian restaurants, French, barbecue, seafood restaurants. We did actually a restaurant that was considered a high-end Mexican restaurant called Hat Dance, which was in Chicago. And I set up a sushi or a raw bar, really, but it was a combination of the influence of Japan, Korea, Peru, and Mexico. So it was all these raw fish dishes that were influenced with all these flavors. So that was, in a sense, a precursor to I mean, that was another part, you know, other than being in Japan. And these were my creative ideas. So the foundation had been put down. I even talked to Rich Melman about doing a restaurant based on that, and he felt like the public wasn't ready for it. So that was around 1989, I think. So I stayed with Lettuce Entertainer for 7 years. Then after that, I left and started my own consulting company. That was prior to opening Oya. So that was for about 12 years. And then I went back, and I was traveling not only all over the U.S., but also back to Europe. I did a lot of work in London and France and Germany. And also in Asia, I did some restaurants for some people in Hong Kong. And I have traveled to Thailand and Taiwan. I haven't actually opened any restaurants there, but I did a few in Hong Kong with a restaurant group there.
So based on, you know, experience at Let Us Entertain You and your consulting, how many restaurant concepts did you develop or help to develop?
Well, I've been part of opening probably close to 60 restaurants. And that spans everything. It's individual owners. When I was consulting, it's restaurants would let us entertain you. I think the combination of those two is, and that's a lot of restaurants too. and I'm tired. So.
Right. Okay. So eventually you decided to open. So why is Japanese food?
Well, originally, we were going to open the restaurant. I remember this was probably in the late 1997, 98. I was reading in Hong Kong and out of the U.S., there were these kind of underground restaurants in people's houses, in their homes. So we originally were going to open up an underground restaurant in our house. Okay. And we were just going to take a room and turn it into a little counter. Mm-hmm. But then when we were in a little town, we called up and just started asking questions about the health department and everything. We just realized that we don't think it would be a good idea, to take on the legal risks didn't want to just put ourselves in a bad situation. So why Japanese? When I fell in love with the Japanese culture, what I loved about the flavors of Japan were how much was accomplished in one bite. And so that really, you know, I thought of taking that thought and then expanding on that. The most important part of to me is our sushi rice, even though we have a lot more than sushi. Our sushi rice is very traditional method, and as we spoke about the other day, Japan's no different than any other country, and everyone has their own way of doing their rice and flavoring things and all that. There's not, you know, a set standard like Italy and all the regions with pasta and all that.
Right.
But I thought the Japanese flavors and taking that format to me was a great canvas to take all the flavors that I liked to work with, because I really like strong hesitate to use the word umami, but I'm really drawn towards that, the really bold, strong flavors.
Right.
So chilies fish sauce, the different soy variations and soy sauce.
So just in case for listeners who are not familiar with the word umami, umami is a savory taste, fifth taste after salty, sweet, bitter, sour.
Yes.
Right. So, and then it's becoming kind of common term, but it's really easy to say, but not easy to actually express it, utilize it.
Yeah, it's hard to conceptualize it, but I think when we talk to our staff, I try to put it in terms that they can understand it. So I'll often use an example of Michael Jordan, the basketball player, when he was not only was a great individual player, but he elevated everybody that played with him. So I look at umami kind of the Michael Jordan of flavor, where what it does is take all the other flavor and elevates it. So I think that it makes it a little more clear to understand, because it's not as, from a pure flavor standpoint, it's not necessarily salty, sweet, sour, bitter. It just elevates all those.
Right. That's really true. Like, say, Parmigiano, and there's a saltiness and umami.
Yes.
I think they have to be together.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, when I think of using different flavors or interchanging flavors. So if I want to, you know, I think miso to me is very similar to Parmesan. So it, and it's it has just the fermentation of both of them, and that's the umami. But I find that you can use both of those and it can still taste Japanese, but you're using Parmesan, and maybe you don't taste the Parmesan, but it elevates the miso.
Right. Okay. So that's very interesting. And I think let's take a quick break here.
Okay.
And when we come back, we'll talk about what kind of food you serve at Oya.
Okay.
So please stay with us.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
You are listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Tim Cushman, who is the chef owner of Oya, the award-winning Japanese restaurant in Boston and in New York, which just opened last month. So, what is the meaning of Oya?
That's a good question. The meaning of Oya involves my wife, Nancy, and myself. We were, when we were trying to think of, we hadn't thought of a name for the restaurant, and we're eating in a sushi restaurant, and we forgot to order something, and we both at the same time said, we forgot to order that, or let's order that, and we both went, oh, yeah. And it was one of those napkin moments, and then we started writing on the napkin different spellings, and it just stuck with us, and we did some research and, you know, find out what it said. And the first thing we did, we looked in a Japanese dictionary, and the first thing it said was gee whiz. There was a lot of other definitions for it, but we thought, okay, that sounds like fun. Mm-hmm. So, the restaurant is meant to be fun, and so it really, I fit with the vibe that we wanted to have in the restaurant.
Right. I think it's working. So, what kind of food do you serve at Oya? I mean, in Boston and New York, basically the food is the same concept?
Yes. It's through my eyes or through my palate. In Boston, we actually have a large a la carte menu. In New York, we're doing tasting menus. Mm-hmm. But conceptually, it's the same in the format of the progression of flavors in the tasting menus is the similar same approach.
Okay. So do you call it contemporary Japanese cuisine?
Yes. Yes, I would call it that. Mm-hmm. whenever we, the tasting menus themselves, 50% of it is sushi, but the other 50% isn't. And when we're working on new nigiri ideas, because we don't do rolls or maki rolls, and it's all nigiri one bite, the one rule I have is that it has to work with the rice. That's the most important thing.
Right, because as you said earlier, it's a foundation of Japanese cuisine.
Yes.
And your canvas.
Yes.
Right. But, you know, you could have done maybe sushi rolls because it's so popular here, but why you didn't?
I think for the, and mostly when you get rolls, you don't see what's in the roll.
Okay.
You do if, it depends how it's presented, you can see some of it. Mm-hmm. But I think for the flavors that I wanted to use, where I wanted to highlight or have the fish, you know, really be the, or whatever is on there, because we don't have just fish, we have vegetables and, and meats and things that we put on sushi. But whatever was on the rice, that was the feature, and then anything in, along with the rice, and then anything that was an additional flavor to it had to work with both of those. That's the rule that I use. So any of the embellishments of flavor that I use, the rice and the, say it's tuna, you have to taste that, and that has to be the winner.
Right. Okay. Yeah, by the way, you know, I didn't mention earlier for listeners, but nigiri means sushi. Basically here, like a small bowl of rice topped with fresh sushi. And I found a little interesting history of nigiri, how it happened. And so basically, it was born in 19th century. It's called also Edomai sushi because it came from Edo period in Tokyo. And it was a product of a booming economy and a culture at that time in Tokyo. And Edo people lived like New Yorkers and working and playing very hard, and then had a very busy lifestyle. As a result of the many fast food businesses, it was, you know, like very becoming successful, and sushi was one of them.
Yes. And again, I'm not a master sushi chef. I, you know, didn't train with master sushi chefs. And my understanding of how sushi came about, or, you know, was discovered, so to speak, goes back, I think, like 800 years or more back to Southeast Asia, where they would use lacto-fermented rice to preserve fish. And then as time went by and it kind of worked its way into Japan, and it was right around the Edo period, I think it was before that, where they started, where rice vinegar was invented. And people, because I think the smell of the lacto-fermented rice in the fish was kind of strong, so they started combining, cutting down on the time that the rice was fermented, and starting adding in rice vinegar to it, and then eventually it turned over just to just cooking the rice and then adding the vinegar to it to get that sour fermented flavor. So and that was right around the Edo period when that whole transition was made, and which was, you know, I found a fascinating fact.
Right on time.
Yeah.
Culture.
Yes.
Right. All right. And by the way, I think the sushi rice, you know, that vinegar, I mean, the sushi rice basically now, this existing time, it's salt, sugar, and vinegar.
Yes.
So I think it really supports umami too, like we spoke earlier.
Yes.
Right.
So and when we cook the rice for our restaurant, we use two different kinds of rices that we combine. One is a little fresher crop, the other one's a little drier, meaning it's they absorb moisture differently. So it gives you a real subtle variance of texture. And then and when we cook the rice, we make a kombu dashi, which is a seaweed dashi. I mean, usually, well, there's a lot of different dashi. The most common one, I guess you'd call it, has bonito and kombu in it. But we use a kombu. And kombu is really loaded with umami.
Glutamic acid.
Yes. And so that starts the umami addition to the rice. And then we, you know, when we warm up our vinegar and salt and sugar, to we also put some kombu in the vinegar. So the vinegar gets infused with a little bit of kombu also. So when we mix the vinegar into the rice, you just get, you know, a little umami going there.
Right. And the other thing about umami is this doesn't add up, it multiplies.
Yes. And sometimes, especially with kombu too, I almost look at umami sometimes as tannic, almost like when you drink a red wine. Because to me, tannins give you a little bit of dryness, you know, on your palate. And I get that I can tell when kombu is in something because I can I get that and I relate that to umami, but it's very similar to the effect of tannins in red wine have on your tongue.
Right. And make you crave more.
Yes, probably. Yes. Yeah, makes food craveable.
Right.
Yes.
All right. So now let's take a look at some of the dishes that you serve at Doya,
okay.
New York. So I was thinking, I had a dinner last week and I still visualize and I get hungry again. A wild king salmon tataki nigiri with tomato confit, smoked salt, onion aioli. So this is a very creative, unique combinations of ingredients and also full of umami.
Yes.
Right.
And that dish, the inspiration to that it was actually a comfort food flavors, which was smoked salmon or lox with bagels and cream cheese.
Mm.
And so what we do with the tomato is to kind of get a consistent tomato flavor, we use extra virgin olive oil and tomato. We take the seeds and skins off the tomato and very slowly confit or cook the tomato in the olive oil. And it softens, it brings the sweetness, you know, the umami of the tomato out a little more. And then the smoked salt is a salt that's sea salt that's smoked over seaweed.
Mm.
And so we sprinkle a little bit of that on the tomato. And then we make our own mayonnaise there. And what we do, a trick I learned a long time ago when I learned to make a Caesar salad, was when you make a dressing that has eggs and oil in it, that emulsification, we'd put hot water and it kind of sets the dressing a lot better.
Hmm.
So when we make our mayonnaise, we actually use hot dashi and add that to the mayonnaise mixture, and it gives it a little dashi and umami boost.
Right.
Again, it fills in flavor holes, as I like to call them. And I think that's, to me, when I think of umami and when I've reached a complete flavor, or I haven't reached a complete flavor, and I always talk with my staff about this, is you're filling in flavor holes. So when you taste something, is it a complete flavor? If it isn't, then what does it need? And a lot of times, just the umami addition or something with an umami part, or something with umami in it,
right.
You know, completes that flavor.
Mm-hmm.
So... going back to that dish, so you're really getting a smoke flavor. You're getting the, in this case, the wild king salmon, and we actually torch the fish a little bit with a really hot torch, just slightly, and that also gives a slight smoky flavor to it, and different than the sea salt. So you have two forms of smokiness, and it also warms up the fats in the salmon slightly, so it brings out the flavor of the salmon a little more also. And then we garnish that with some negi and green onion. And negi is Tokyo leek, which is very similar to leeks, which I think everyone's familiar with, or green onion. It's an onion flavor.
Right.
So you have onions, smoked salmon, and mayonnaise, essentially. So
right. Well, it looks, if you just look at the menu, it sounds like just playful, but there's so many reasons that you put them together.
No, there is... it is very playful. We always say we take what we do very seriously, but we don't take ourselves seriously. So we like to have fun with the flavors and be adventurous, but it has to work. I always kind of, in a funny way, or at least I think it's funny, I always think of, it reminds me of a Japanese way of doing things, but Coco Chanel, when she'd go out, she'll take off one piece of jewelry. So I think of that too. It's like we'll push the flavor and the combinations to a certain point, and when we know we've gone too far, we'll take off that one thing, and usually that settles in then and becomes the final dish.
Mm.
Kind of went off on a tangent there, but
right. Right. Okay. So do you have any other example of your signature dishes here?
I think one, I could, I know we're limited to time. I could mention a lot of them. One is the oyster that we serve there. It's a Kumamoto oyster, and it combines three different influences. One, I love the French way of eating oysters with mignonette. It's nice and simple. I like oysters by themselves, but mignonette, I think, adds to it, and you still taste the oyster. In Japan, and simply when you get it, most times you'll get either a lemon or ponzu. And then it's also, this Kumamoto comes from the West Coast, so it has the melon and cucumber notes. So what we do is take watermelon and use a melon baller and cut them into really tiny pearl-sized balls. and briefly marinate that in ponzu for 30 seconds, and then we make a cucumber mignonette. Mm. So what you're getting is the ponzu flavor, you're getting the watermelon and the cucumber that echo the natural flavors of the oyster, and in the mignonette with that French flavor that I like. So it's really combining a lot of things, but ultimately you still end up tasting the minerality of the oyster in the end.
Right. Yeah, and actually the dish was beautifully presented, like any other dishes, but, you know, every single dish tastes somewhat almost like comfort food, and, you know, you sense, I tasted it somewhere before, and feel, you know, comforted. So is that something, you know, one of the philosophies you have for recipe development?
It's not really something that I've thought about. I really go on what I like, and I think everybody likes food that tastes good. I mean, that sounds kind of simple, but it's food, it's flavors that I like, and I think I don't even think about that, but I do tap into like comfort food flavors and real satisfaction, mm-hmm. And craveability, you know, flavors that you crave. It's like I want, you want to. Hopefully when you come in, you taste it. It's like you crave and you want to go back and taste it some more. Mm. And that's not like a conscious effort. Okay, you know, that's how we're doing it, and this is a written down approach. I think it's more just, it is just what, how I do it.
Right. Okay. And do you have any rules that you never do in developing recipes? Because it's, you still have to kind of stay within the Japanese concept, right?
Yes. Well, always, because our staff... we actually have our staff works on all new ideas with us. So it's not just me. It's I like to have the staff participate in working on new ideas. So I never say never. But there are, you know, certain things that don't work within the flavor profile or sparingly, you know, mm-hmm. they can. And mostly dairy products like cream, or butter, if it gets too heavy, you know, and that it goes in that direction and you're tasting something creamy, it doesn't really fit into, I mean, I love cream and I love butter, it's not really something that, you know, fits within the framework of what we're trying to do. Or something like blue cheese, although we do have a dish that we don't have it on the menu, but we have it off menu, and each night we usually have many dishes that aren't on either, you know, any of the menus. Because we have there's a lot of vegetarians and, people that, you know, love certain things. And so we'll always have things off menu that we can, you know, add into a menu, we have a lot of flexibility with that.
Right.
But the one dish I was going to talk about, it's a French triple cream cheese that we marinate. It's kind of taking the miso marinated technique of black cod, but we do it with cheese. Huh. So it has miso and sake and mirin. And we wrap it in cheesecloth and bury it in the miso for 12 days.
Wow.
And we serve it with an aged sake.
Mm.
But the cheese itself, when you first taste it, it's a great cheese, but, you know, mild or flavored. But once it sits in the miso for 12 days, it just, like, kicks up the flavor, you know, profile unbelievable. And it gets a lot really funky. You know, you can really only take a couple bites. But it goes awesome with the aged sake. It's an eight-year-old aged sake.
Okay.
So it's really just meant to take like two tiny bites and a sip of the sake, but it's like, bam, in your mouth.
Right. Well, I think, your kind of lighthearted attitude towards Japanese food, I think it's very inspiring to Japanese and non-Japanese chefs, because you know the Japanese traditional cuisine. It's hard to cross the border.
Yes.
But you are pushing the envelope, so...
Yes, and it is, and I always tell our staff when we're working on new ideas, you know, include as much Japanese flavors as you can into it. And again, we're very adventurous. I love really spicy food, so we have, you know, all different kinds of chilies that we'll use on different dishes. You know, Thai chilies, jalapeno, dried Mexican chilies, Japanese chili powders, and you know, there's a lot of different directions that we can go in, but I always keep pulling them back, you know, because our tendency is to go into familiar zone, which is, you know, I mean, the Western cooks and stuff, which is more like French influenced.
Right.
But again, I say in the beginning, I say I don't hold anything back. You know, if you can do something that works and blows us away, and it has cream or blue cheese or anything in it, then fine, go for it. But you know, we just has to work. And if it doesn't, I say, okay. But, you know, I'll usually, and I'll guide through, you know, the as they're working on ideas and stuff and say, you know, this part works, this part doesn't, and then offer suggestions of what how they could adapt it to make it work.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, you serve two tasting menus at New York Goya.
Yes.
And one is 18-course omakase.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes a variety of fresh, seasonal, contemporary sushi and sashimi dishes, followed by cooked savory courses and desserts for $185. And the other one is 20-course menu for $245. That's in addition, you have the unique and seasonal ingredients to the first omakase. So it sounds like, you know, American people are interested in Japanese cuisine and are willing to pay. You know, it's not cheap, and they're looking for the experience.
Yes.
So do you think American palate is really ready for the traditional, and they understand traditional, and then on top, now it's at next level of Japanese cuisine, right?
Yes, and I think both, the answer is both, as more traditional Japanese foods come to the United States, you know, we are, you know, the Americans get to see what's really available, that there's a lot of cooked foods, there's a lot of other styles of food in Japan that you haven't seen here yet. But I know the, and as far as the creative Japanese food too, I think there's room for both, and I think there's going to be a big explosion, and especially as chefs, you know, discover more and more about Japan and the products and the ingredients, I think you're going to see a lot more of that influence in restaurants. And I think, you know, people at home, just with the exposure of the world, you know, with the internet and, you know, social media and everything, I think all that is going to pique people's curiosities, and they're getting more adventurous,
right,
which is great.
And also heard that Japanese people, like traditionalists, even really enjoy your food in Boston and New York too.
Yes, and that's actually huge compliments to us when you know, we've had our Japanese guests come in, because I always picture the restaurant as, you know, when before we opened, I always envisioned what it would be, that it would be accepted in Japan, but using my Western sensibilities and but combining that with the traditional Japanese flavors and methods, my goal was to, I want this restaurant to, that if we opened in Japan, it would be accepted there, and people would like it a lot. And we've had, you know, a lot of our Japanese guests that have come in have said exactly that, and say, you know, this really, I can really taste Japan in this, but I can taste, you know, your flavors added into it, and it works.
So maybe Oya Japan is coming.
I would love to do that.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us today, Tim, and good luck with Oya New York, and hopefully Oya Tokyo.
Yes, and thanks thanks for having us today. I mean, it was a lot of fun, and we feel very lucky and humbled to be in New York, and, you know, knock on wood, you know, we hope we do really well here, but thanks for having us.
Sure. So, listeners, if you'd like to know more about Oya, please visit Oya restaurant, oya.restaurant, which is o-ya.restaurant. And if you have any questions or comments, please contact us at heritageradionetwork.org. And you can also reach me at akikokatayama.com. Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.